To this week's guest, Parag Khanna, the modern era resembles the Middle Ages, with Asian empires, Western militaries, Middle Eastern sheikdoms, magnetic city-states, multinational commercial powers, transnational elites, and religious zealots all playing roles, and roles potentially more meaningful in many cases than those played by nation-states. Just as that initial Dark Age ended with the Renaissance, Khanna believes that a new enlightened age could emerge from today's dangerous chaos. But his vision depends on harnessing our technology and connectedness to forge new networks among governments, businesses, and civic interest groups to confront the crises of today and avert those of tomorrow. Khanna believes a new mega-diplomacy, consisting of coalitions among government, business, philanthropy, activists, and everyday people, will be able to assemble the talent, pool the money, and deploy the resources to make the global economy fairer, rebuild failed states, combat terrorism, promote good governance, prevent environmental collapse, and deliver food, water, healthcare, and education to those in need. Nation-states rule the 20th century for good and ill, but their power to solve our planet's important problems seems very shaky. For the next hour, I will explore with Parag Khanna the provocative and ambitious approach he writes about in his new book, How to Run the World. Parag Khanna is a senior research fellow in the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. In 2008, he was named one of Esquire's 75 most influential people of the 21st century, a young global leader of the World Economic Forum, and one of 15 people on Wired magazine's Smart List. He holds a Ph.D. from the London School of Economics and bachelor's and master's degrees from the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He's author of the international bestseller The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order, and his newest, How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. Welcome again, Parag.
So
and I think I got your role at New America wrong, did I?
No, you got it exactly right.
Okay. Because I know there was, you're also something to do with global governance, but it's still within the American strategy.
Yeah, well, area. Global governance is everything now, isn't it?
Oh, isn't it? Okay, so as what I like listeners to get a feel for the people mm-hmm. behind the work and the ideas. So you're still pretty young. You're either 33 or 34.
Yep, 33.
And you've done and accomplished quite a lot. Briefly. Talk a little bit about the path that you followed to the work that you're doing these days.
The path has been a path of travel. That's really my methodology. I always tell people, I write books that get taught in universities and classrooms all over the world, but I always emphasize that my methodology is to travel. The only common denominator in everything I've ever done is that I always want to be someplace where I'm not, or I don't like to be stationary. I always like to be on the move. There are many places where I say I don't even like to go twice. I would never, not the kind of person who would ever get a timeshare, let's just say. So, it all started really, though, when I was in high school in New York and decided to become an exchange student. This is in the early 90s, so fall of the Berlin Wall, opening up of the Iron Curtain. And I went and traveled around Europe for a year and learned German and other languages and really just was exposed to the whole post-Cold War order. And that really got me started. And so I've just been traveling and traveling ever since. And now I've been to well over 100 countries. I kind of count down to what are the places left that I really want to go to in the world. But my wife warned me recently. She said, you know, it's not about countries anymore. It's about cities. So that kind of ups the number of places I need to go from 200 countries to thousands of interesting cities. So I've still got a long way to go.
Okay. By the way, I was wondering whether you were married or single and how you were able to pull off that much travel. You must have a very understanding spouse.
Well, now we do it together, and we have a child as well. And our little daughter, who is not even 2 years old, has been to almost 20 countries. So now, it can be done for all of you out there who want to know how to have kids and travel.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that was the thought that was going through my head.
That's how we want her to grow up.
Well, will be a global citizen.
She's a globalista.
Yeah. Oh, very exciting. Now, let me ask one thing that might be slightly embarrassing. Your publisher, Random House, says that you are the most esteemed and innovative adventurer scholar of your generation. Did you know that?
No, I think that terminology.
Adventurer scholar.
Well, this is good.
Is that because of the travel?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it is an adventure. So they could have said traveler or scholar, I suppose. The scholar is not debatable. maybe it is. I don't know. But adventure, yes, I love it. I've worked for the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan and traveled around a lot of dangerous places. I've done a lot of physical adventures.
And you've climbed mountains and...
I have, yeah, any number of 20,000 foot peaks. And this summer I drove from London to Mongolia, about 8,000 miles in an old beat-up ambulance for a charity event, a charity race, and that was an amazing adventure as well. So I do love to see the world.
So you don't poo-poo it. You say that's better. I mean, you're lucky enough to do it.
It is the only way. I mean, so many of the arguments from my last book that contradict conventional wisdom about for example, is India really a superpower? What about Russia and these kinds of things? You could never make the arguments that I make about those places without really going and seeing just what life is like on the ground. Particularly Russia was reinforced to me this summer when crossing Siberia in this old ambulance and seeing all of the boarded up villages and just how dilapidated the country is. So anytime I see a magazine cover that says the new Cold War is back and Russia is resurgent, I just have to laugh because those people have just not been there.
Right. Right. Yeah. It that is so in a magazine.
Yeah. Totally.
I also want to ask one question, which I sometimes, as I'm preparing for an interview, I think of some of these big questions about how someone works and so on, and then they end up falling off at the end, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to throw this one in. How do you arrive at a book? And what I mean by that is you look at huge amounts of information, analysis, experience, travel, all of this from all over the place, as we've shown, literally as well as figuratively. When do you go, I think there's a theme here. How does that happen?
Well, the theme comes way before the idea to turn the theme into a book. You know, and in that sense, I come at it from an intellectual or scholarly standpoint where I say there is a academic debate or there's a conventional wisdom in the world about America being the sole superpower, for example, just to use my first book as an example, where I'm, you know, in the corridors of power in Washington, I'm at the Brookings Institution, and everyone just assumes that this unipolarity and American dominance in the world will continue. I'm saying this simply is not correct. How is it then that I have this stack of books on my desk about China as an emerging power? And then there's a smaller stack, but there's a whole set of books about the European Union presenting the real true model for the future as this transnational, supranational kind of entity. This can't be correct. So I'm going to set off. I'm going to travel to the places where those decisions are being made as to who's going to lead the future, and I'm going to talk to people. And, you know, so that's how that concept crystallized. For this one, for How to Run the World, it's been in the works in my mind since even before Second World was, because this global governance question that, you know, this term that you mentioned earlier about how do we run the world? Diplomacy. What is the structure of diplomacy? Is it easy enough to say, let's just go to the United Nations and they'll solve the problems? Or count on Obama now that he's president and America will be welcome as a leader around the world again. Is that really going to stabilize our world? Is it going to make it a better place, which is the point of your program? And my answer was most definitely no. It's far too simple. Silver bullets. This book got started because I hate silver bullets, because they never work. And you hear about these silver bullets all the time. What's the most recent one? The G20, right? We have the G20. The financial crisis is solved. World economic stability will return. There'll be growth and, you know, so forth. Again, nonsense. And now you have people saying, well, let's have the G20 do climate change, and they'll solve the Iranian nuclear program too. They'll probably bring peace to Palestine as well. It will not happen. So what really animates, motivates me is this almost this visceral quest to get people to accept complexity. So one of the things I point out here is it's not about China replacing America. The Asian century is another phrase that you can't help but hear or see on every billboard practically. It's not true. The Atlantic and the Pacific, America and China, East and West, we're all going to coexist. It's going to be a complicated world. And then on top of that, you've got your cities, your corporations, your religious groups, your NGOs, your philanthropists, your activists, your universities, you name it. Everyone is a diplomat. Everyone has a role in this incredibly complicated sort of ecosystem of global governance. And this is the book, I think, that kind of steps ahead of the others and says, accept this complexity for what it is. I want to embarrass people to no longer accept silver bullets when they hear them. And I think that is kind of the educative function.
Very good. I tell you, one thing that's interesting is, you know, you mentioned what the show is about and so on. And it seems to me that in almost every area I look at, one of the lessons or one of the things that the kinds of ideas and people I'm gravitating towards are the ones who say it's not that simple.
Right.
You know, whether it's education or health or environment or anything.
Yeah.
And what we know is that it's easier for scholars if you pretend it's simple.
Yeah.
It's easier for writers, and it's easier
for politicians. For the public, for voters.
Yeah.
It's so easy to make it easy, but it always fails.
Yeah. I want to talk just a little bit more about the Second World,
mm-hmm.
okay? For those who are not familiar, you sort of introduced the idea that people had been talking about unipolar or U.S.-China, that sort of thing. And you really said that it's more complex than that. What is the big message of the Second World?
Well, the Second World countries are those 40 or 50 countries that are what a lot of people call emerging markets. And so when you're talking about Brazil or Russia or Saudi Arabia, Iran, Indonesia, India, all these places that are popping up in the news because they've got the oil, they've got the sovereign wealth funds, you know, all of these things that are reshaping our global economy. They've got the high growth, the resources. So I decided I would travel through all of those countries, 40 or 50 of them, and profile them in this book and do what I call geopolitical psychoanalysis. What is it like to think like one of these places, to go and spend time there? If they were being wooed by America with promises of weapons, or wooed by Europe with promises of aid, or wooed by China with promises of financing and trade, who would they decide to ally with in a kind of neutral playing field, or what I called in that book the geopolitical marketplace? And that's, let's face it, that's exactly how the world has become ever more. Every day of the week, we see it more and more. We see the relationships and the deals being cut between China and Saudi Arabia. I thought Saudi Arabia was America's loyal ally. Oops, right? I mean, look where the oil is going now. Look where they're buying the weapons from now. We think of Pakistan today as, you know, that's America's ally in the war on terror. Well, let's see. You know, where is their aid money coming from, by and large? Who's building their infrastructure? What about Africa, right? I mean, look at China and Africa. So I went to all these places over the course of 2005, 2006, 2007, and I started to kind of paint this picture of this changing psychological world order. And basically, it's a world where everyone is out for themselves. And this new book is almost an extension of that, saying that's not just every country that's out
for
itself. It's every company. It's every NGO. They're doing whatever they want. Everyone has their own foreign policy. Bono has his own foreign policy. The One campaign. You know, he advertises in The Economist saying, I need a foreign policy advisor. You know, people to that job.
I bet.
So, you know, what I want is for all you Model UN players out there in high school and college and beyond, you know, this is saying, let's move beyond Model UN. You need a simulation in which when you sign up to play a role, you can be Gazprom, you can be Royal Dutch Shell, you can be Osama bin Laden, you can be Bill Gates, you can be Bono, whatever the case may be, not just I represent the President of the United States and I represent the Premier of China. The world is, again, like way more complicated than that.
Yeah. Have any things that you were thinking in that book, it sounds like most of your experience since then has been confirmed. Anything surprised you?
Well, in the last few years, the book has held up. The fall of the Tunisian, leader is very interesting because it's a country that, of course, I'm very familiar with how authoritarian and repressive the regime has been, but it also had, a better educational system. It had more sort of, you know, human rights, women's rights, economic freedoms than other Arab countries have. It's consistently rated the most liberal economy in the Arab world and so forth. So in many ways, it was a role model for other Arab countries. Remember, you're not going to turn Iraq into Switzerland, right?
Right.
What is the next best thing? And this is something I get way more into in this book, about just saying, let's be more modest about what we can achieve in failed states like Afghanistan or Yemen or whatever. Again, they're not going to be like Sweden or Norway just because they have natural resources. Just look for a local role model. And Tunisia actually was that role model for like a Syria or a Saudi Arabia. You know, at least let them invest in their people. At least let them have infrastructure. At least bring in some technology. And Tunisia actually did those things. So the fall of that government is interesting because I certainly never bought into the myth, but I said, let's at least copy these few things. But maybe the hope is that Tunisia will do a better job and be more democratic in the next few weeks, months, and years. Let's see what happens. But it's a very exciting development.
Now, it's interesting because as I'm listening to you, I'm saying, well, we're looking for what are the lessons of Tunisia. But if I'm an autocratic regime in the Middle East, and I'm looking for one of the lessons of Tunisia. Might I take the other lesson? That's what they get for liberalizing?
Well, no, it's not what they get for liberalizing. It's because they were corrupt. I mean, you know, liberalism, freedom is to be expected. You're not going to get any special brownie points for giving your people basic human rights. Yeah. They expect it and they deserve it. But for being as corrupt as they were, as the WikiLeaks cable revealed, and let's remember,
that's right,
part of this has its origin in
part
US.
Of this overthrow actually can be linked back to WikiLeaks.
From an American ally. Exactly. You know, so the overthrow of an American ally.
Well, explain what was discovered in the WikiLeaks for those who aren't aware.
So, I mean, one of the American ambassador's cables regarding the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia pointed to just how profligate and corrupt and, self-aggrandizing they were financially and real estate and other sorts of things. And the publication of that and the way in which Al Jazeera played it up as well for the whole Arab world to understand and see in their own language, really together helped to fuel the protests on the street. And they, kind of like Ukraine in 2004, 2005, and other countries, when the people just won't go away, eventually the police forces, security services are going to back down. And they're going to say, you know what, this isn't worth it. And it's the tipping point. So we're really, it's early days yet, but we know from the reporting that we're seeing that governments all over the region, especially Egypt, which should be scared anyway, but is very scared now. I think it's a beautiful thing. I really do.
Very good. I did want to get to Tunisia. And also, it doesn't get lost as we get into the conversation. What about what just happened in Sudan?
Right, absolutely. And this is a big theme in this new book as well, is that, when we say the world and the state, we assume that all governments are sovereign and coherent and unified, even though ours really isn't either, but let alone the Western world and the crises of governance that you have in Europe. But so why would you assume that Sudan is coherent? And what most of the world is, there are 200 countries in the world. Most of the countries in the world are post-colonial countries. And most of the post-colonial countries in the world are failing or falling apart kinds of states.
And as you point out, their failure is in some sense in their origin.
Absolutely.
They were not, they didn't arise out of something on the ground. They were set by folks in Geneva.
Yeah. When people say failed state, it's like, oh, these are countries that because the Soviet Union isn't propping them up anymore, or we're not, they're collapsing. No. This was really built into their DNA, because when these countries were born in the 50s and 60s, out of the wreckage of European empires after World War II, in the last three generations since then, they've been failing. They've been failing every day. They haven't built new infrastructure. They haven't created a national ethos. Overpopulation has absolutely gripped these countries. Some populations tripling, quadrupling in over a 30, 40-year period with no capacity to manage it. And immense amounts of corruption by very, very self-serving leaders. So this goes to the Congo and Mobutu Sese Seko and then Sudan. And a lot of these countries were also constructed wrong. The borders were made in haste. And like in Sudan, you've got the Arab North and then the Black African South forced into one country. And these are enormous countries. You know, Sudan is much larger than California. And
it's the second largest
country in Africa behind Congo. And they're almost equal size. So it's remarkable these countries have held together this long at all.
So specifically, how did when I first I wasn't following Sudan closely. When I first saw this vote is going to be taken, I thought, that's so civil, so rational. How did something like that happen?
This referendum has been in the works for years, and it really is a great example of good at diplomacy, because it's the U.S., it's the EU, it's the United Nations, it's the African Union, it's all of these different players getting together and pressuring the Sudanese regime piece by piece by piece to set the date for, to respect the outcome of, and to allow freely the process of this referendum to take place such that South Sudan could vote for its own independence, which it's assured going to do. And it's a role model, because if you think about it, we have this phobia about creating new states. We're like, uh-oh, Yugoslavia, it's going to be ugly, it's going to be genocidal, or the partition of South Asia, India and Pakistan, right? Millions of people. My father was a refugee from that partition. So, we have this phobia. However, if you don't allow these new countries to be born, you'll continue to have this, what I call cartographic stress. The military-industrial complex around the world is very much built around border conflicts. And if you didn't have border wars, why would you need all the armies? Why would you need the Air Force? Why would you need the bombs? Why would you need the tanks? Here you're creating a case. Yes, of course, independent countries are going to have their own armed forces. But what I find, if you look at the history of Europe, for example, only after centuries of bloody conflict in which every tribe, every people got their your own country. They eliminated the borders, right?
The European Union.
Yeah. The European Union has no borders.
Comes out of World War II and finally says two of those wars in that period is enough. We're a modern world and we'll find a new way.
So now we've got South Sudan. It's not done yet. Obviously, we're not out of the woods, but it looks like it's going to be good. And that then it becomes a role model for Kurdistan, for Palestine, for other parts of the world, that, you know, other peoples that truly deserve their own independent states that have been subjugated for millennia in the case of the Kurds, literally 3,000 years of being subdued by Turks, by Persians, by Arabs, right? They need to have their own country. That's the only way. So only if you're conservative or if you're a coward, I would say, would you be opposed to the eventual independence of a Kurdistan state. So I think that if South Sudan goes well, it might start to just increase the
appetite. Let me ask you, you said that the referendum in Sudan, about South Sudan, has been in the works for years. Are these other places that you think would, where they would do well, are they in the works or?
Well, let's just take Palestine. I mean, how many Rose Garden ceremonies have we had about that one, right? How many Nobel prizes have we given out prior to peace? So yes, I mean, it says every declaration says we need to move towards a two-state solution. All the accords say that. So when are we finally going to have it? I think you have to change the facts on the ground. They have to build the infrastructure that allows Palestine to be a viable state. And if and when it can be viable, then they can just diplomatically declare it. And, you know, that really changes the terms.
And let's just talk briefly about that. The most exciting, positive news I read about Palestine and Israel is the economic information out of Palestine.
Yes. I mean, the economy of the West Bank, at least, is on a better trajectory than it was in the past. They're enjoying relative internal stability. There's jobs being created. But the West Bank issue now looms large because the two are not connected. I'm a big proponent of
connected geographically.
Exactly. And the RAND Corporation, right down the street from here, several years ago produced a study called The Arc. And The Arc was this trunk or corridor of railways, roads, and other sorts of, bus lines and irrigation that would connect Gaza and the West Bank. And remember, Gaza has the access to the Mediterranean Sea, so you could have an airport, a seaport, other sorts of things to export and import goods. If you can connect the two parts of Palestine, you could have a viable economy for the Palestinian people. They could have their own functioning state. And the nice thing is that if and when they did, they wouldn't necessarily be fighting a hostile war with Israel, right? They would probably be trading with each other. It would make a lot more sense. Again, Europe is the best guide for this. So I think we're inching closer and closer and closer towards this independent Palestinian state, potentially this year. It could happen this year.
Even given the politics on the ground in Israel?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, remember, it's also external pressure. There's a great deal more frustration with Israel now among Western powers than there has been in years past. That long, long leash is getting shorter and shorter. And at some point, for their own diplomatic credibility, the United States and others have to say, you know what, we're just going to not switch sides, but we're going to force this solution on them because we're the ones who are getting hurt.
Yeah. I remember when Bush was intent on intervening in Iraq. I said, if you're going to do a preemptive action anywhere where you're going to play outside the boundaries, do it in Palestine and Israel, where it would actually make a difference for the world.
Wish he listened to you.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't.
He didn't listen to me either. Don't
you've brought up Europe a couple of times. This is going to be a long question because I care about this one a lot. The bad news of the euro crisis makes headlines in the U.S., but we hear next to nothing about the good news. Okay, and so for those who haven't heard me on this soapbox before, the European Union, 27 member nations, half a billion people, the largest, wealthiest trading bloc in the world, nearly a third of the world's economy, nearly as large as the U.S. and China combined, more Fortune 500 companies than either the U.S., China, or Japan. European nations spend far less than the U.S. for universal health care rated by the World Health Organization best in the world, twice as energy efficient as the U.S., an ecological footprint half the size of the U.S. for the same standard of living, and before the recession, Americans were working nearly 400 more hours per year than Germans. So I've done interviews this year with Stephen Hill on Europe's Promise,
colleague
of yours at New America, and Tom Gagan, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? When I turned Were You Born on the Wrong Continent into a print interview at Alternet, it was the number one read, number one emailed for a week. I am supremely frustrated by the ignorance of Americans about other models, other successful models for how to do democracy, how to do capitalism, and so on. Your
and if
thoughts.
We don't know them, who do we know? Because we came from there. At least many of us did. Look, I mean, you know, everything you said right out of Steve Hill's book, right out of my Second World book, where I treat the European Union as a superpower. Mine was the first book to do that and say European Union really is a geopolitical heavyweight because of its economic power, because of the attractiveness of its model. All of those things are actually still true. First of all, we just love to badmouth and poo-poo, you know, whoever it is, in this case, the Europeans, as if we don't have our own problems. Greece is, as people know, probably the size of Alabama or something in terms of economic weight. It's not exactly going to bring down the European Union.
The contrast there is the shape that California's economy is in, and California is a significant piece of the U.S. Greece, a minor piece, 2% versus 20%.
There's one thing that I wrote very clearly, which I think will resonate. You could not pay a German person to move to the United States of America. The quality of life in Germany, a large industrialized country. We're not talking, I mean, it's an unfair comparison to say, oh, look, Norwegians live better than Americans. That's a small country. Germany has 85 million people. It's a very big country.
And it is,
industrial
depending
power.
On currency,
the largest exporter.
It's either the largest exporter
exactly.
or number two.
Right.
With 85 million versus us with 340.
Yeah. The median German, not the average German, but probably that as well, but the median German lives so much better than the median American, it would be a massive step backwards for any one of them to move to the United States of America. You've said it, I've said it, the statistics bear it out.
What do you think, this is the thing that where I get on my soapbox, is how are we in this country, even progressives who say what we're doing isn't working, so pathologically unable to look across the ocean and see these models and begin to move for them? What do you think it is in our culture?
Well, I mean, whatever it is we're finally doing. Well, obviously, it's our sense of exceptionalism has got to be part of it. The sense, the general ignorance of the rest of the world, because we are a gigantic country. We are a world unto ourselves. And by the way, I always defend that. When people say, oh, look, you know, only one-third of Americans have passports. It's like, look, that's a silly statistic. America is a humongous country. You could spend your whole life and never really see all of America. So America is an amazing, vast, great empire, a wilderness unto itself. You don't have to have a passport. You really don't have to leave America to be a cultured person. That's not the metric to be used.
Very good. Yeah.
But in our politics, in our economic system, that's where it's a level playing field around the world today. There's a reason why people are saying there's a China model, there's a Europe model, there's an India model. I don't think there's really a good India model, but there are these other ways to go about economic management, and that's a technocratic issue. We need to be open to what people are experimenting with around the world, about whether it's tax systems, whether it's healthcare, whether it's service delivery, all these infrastructure. There's really good data around all this. To ignore it is to really to be myopic.
And you seem to be, you were about to say as you began that you think it's shifting.
Yes, I do. Because of the financial crisis, obviously. Because, look, we've bailed out our largest industries. We've done what Europeans do. We are subsidizing major companies, right? We're moving towards universal healthcare. Of course, there's nothing new for Europeans. They've had it for a long time. So, of course, we are actually becoming more European, right? Like it or not, it's absolutely irrelevant what your opinion is. The facts are we are spending money in ways that Europeans do. We're learning to copy elements of their models that have made them places that have less inequality than we have. Our level of income inequality is like very poor African countries. You know, theirs is not. What kind of system would you rather have? It's a very simple question. You know, it may be emotional.
Emotional resistance to it. But you do see it.
Well, don't call it European. Just call it smart.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. No, I mean, the one thing that I point out about Germany is, you know, it's not just all the government. A corporation with 2,000 employees in Germany, half of the board is elected by the workers.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
and the CEO only earns like 30 times as much as the lowest level, rather than 3,000 times as much. Yeah,
I mean, yeah, I do have the feeling if people knew these things, it would be a very different.
And
feeling.
They're not lies. These are not conspiracy. This is not freedom fries.
And it's not
here.
Huge government conspiracy.
No,
it's the people choosing to.
We'll be copying Germany a lot more, especially given this latest data about their export dominance. It really is shocking, and it just shows. I mean, look, we're in Los Angeles. How many people out there are driving German cars right now? A lot of you, okay? And there's a reason why. How come they make cars that you buy and you're not buying American cars?
I think it was Tom Gagin who said we should not be competing. We should not think of ourselves as competing with China. We should be competing with Germany for China to buy our products.
For the Chinese, yes,
and
absolutely.
That's what Germany said, we'll make things better, and people will buy them. You say some things. America has learned the hard way that what others want for their future is more important than what America wants, period. There is just one principle left that America can embody in a world where every country is out for itself, helping others help themselves, and so on. What is America's role in this new world?
This new Middle Ages, basically.
Yeah.
We still have a lot of opportunities. America can still be a tremendous leader. But what I focus on in this new book is about Americans, not just the American government. To me, again, every American can be a diplomat. The Gates Foundation does more for public health around the world than the U.S. government does. It's a private actor. It doesn't go to Washington to get told what to do. It just goes and does it. And it doesn't go and undermine countries around the world. There's actually a lot of controversy about this. People say, oh, look, the Gates Foundation, who is it accountable to? It's running its own show. It's weakening public institutions in other countries. Absolutely not. First of all, public health infrastructure in Africa is not exactly something to write home about. Everything the Gates Foundation does is effectively still contributing to building capacity in those countries, ever more so. 80% of their spending actually goes to support public-private partnerships. So they are actually supporting public institutions a great deal. So, a lot of the things I point to are what American charities, philanthropists, companies, corporate citizenship programs, even our hated, nefarious oil companies, actually can do a lot of good work around the world when it comes to training local management in resource extraction or public management of those resources. It's not all corrupt.
Not all how to get around the regulations.
Exactly. No, there's a lot of mechanisms out there that I talk about in this book, such as the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, where what you have going on is a mix of the World Bank and the energy companies and the local government and local civil society in places like Angola or in other West African countries, where they all have to get together in a room and say, okay, we're going to disclose how much money we're giving you, and then you have to report to your local civil society committee, and then you have to have a budgetary committee that the World Bank is going to play a role in to spend it on public goods so that it's not all corrupt. Now, it's messy. It takes a lot of glue. It takes a lot of diplomacy to get this to work right. But what's the alternative? The alternative is saying, oh, the oil curse, man. When they get oil, they're screwed. There's going to be civil war 5 years from now. We can beat this. And it takes just a lot of effort from, again, a collection of public and private actors. And that's what this book is all about.
Right.
In America, it can provide an amazing amount of assistance in this regard. Just take Africa. Africa is the place where we're saying China is coming in. They're turning into new colonies. They're stealing all the resources. They're sending all their own workers there. It doesn't have to be that way. Right. There's a lot of Chinese investment infrastructure, which is a good thing. Every country needs infrastructure, right? If we're not building it, I'm glad China is. But what can we do? We can help these African governments take all this money and not blow it, right? We can help them make sure that it serves the people, education, health, welfare, all these other kinds of things. The Chinese are not going to encourage those governments to do that, but we can. And if we help others help themselves, we're going to be the winners in the soft power game.
Loyalty will be to us. When we did a great job of helping others help themselves was at the end of World War II.
Absolutely.
And the result of that is Japan, is right. Germany, is the European Union, ultimately.
Yeah.
And do you see, and I think the other clear thing that you said is that when one talks about America's role today, they're no longer talking about Washington.
Exactly.
They're talking about Americans' role because the role of anyone has shifted.
Yeah. Go to another country and ask them who they'd rather have come visit their high school auditorium or even their ministries or their companies. It's not Hillary Clinton, as much as people may like her. They want CEOs. They want America's CEOs. They want America's universities. They want the deans of admissions of the Ivy League schools. They want the CEOs of America's tech companies to come to their countries. They don't care about diplomats reading stale speeches. Right? They want technology, they want education, they want jobs. They're not going to get that from the American government in other countries. We have a hard enough time creating jobs in our country. But technology companies, automobile manufacturers, whatever the case may be, or auto parts manufacturers, the Marshall Plan was partially self-serving, of course. You have to build these economies. They're buying American goods, lend-lease, and all of that. Mm-hmm. It's much the same today. When the data shows that when American companies expand abroad, they don't necessarily just outsource everything and fire all the Americans. They generate a lot of revenues that can be reinvested into the United States in higher-end kinds of work. So the issue isn't that companies don't create jobs in the United States. The issue is what kind of jobs at what skill level and so forth. That's a policy problem that we have to solve. But American companies going abroad, selling, whether it's Coca-Cola, whether it is Hollywood, whether it is also American universities, whether it is America's car manufacturers, they make more money outside the United States than they do in the United States. That is a good thing. by selling over there, they're at least they need to pay more taxes here.
So how do you see the issue of, we talked about it before when we contrasted the way the U.S., it seems, as they saw the rise of China, India, Korea, etc., and saw the ability to ship jobs elsewhere so that the American manufacturers could make more money, while Germany saw, oh, we better get really good at what we do. How do you solve that problem? Because we have, I mean, I see this as not just, I really don't look at it as a problem between us and China, but as a problem between us and ourselves, or us and a country like Germany.
And we talked about Germany earlier, and I said we're going to be looking at them, because one thing they do very well is vocational education.
Absolutely.
Something we don't do so well here. You know, they have the option for students to go through all these technical training centers to learn how to be engineers, mechanics, whatever the case may be. Those kinds of jobs that, again, make BMW, Audi, Volkswagen, Mercedes, Porsche, you know, you're all driving those cars out there, you know, make those the import of choice in for the growing middle class in China, India, and elsewhere. We're not making those cars that are the import choice, because we're not training people to be the best designers, the best engineers, the best mechanics, whatever. But we do obviously high-end things extremely well. I mean, there's a reason why Microsoft, Google, Facebook, all these things are American companies.
So with the financial crisis in this country, and the fact that all these things, you know, it's like we're realizing what we should be investing in at a time when it seems we have very little to invest.
Part of it is actually, again, public-private partnerships. Our own companies can help to train that workforce of the future. McKinsey is, you know, trains people or runs a program on healthcare management. So that's one of the fastest growing fields in the United States, especially with healthcare reform. They're
right.
Growing
as much as there is medical tourism.
Right.
Healthcare is something that basically you do at home.
Yeah.
It stays home.
Yeah. By and large, medical tourism is a tiny infinitesimal fraction of global medical care, and even especially in the United States. And we have great healthcare in pockets. But again, hospitals, healthcare management, all these kind of delivery services to an aging population, baby boomers, it's going to be one out of every X, you know, workers in the United States. But what about the training for it? So companies are saying, we're not going to wait for the universities to do it. We're going to wait for public spending to come along to train workers in this. We can actually sell this as a service at a lower cost, efficiently, certificates that 1-year programs, those types of things, and get workers trained in those areas, and they'll get jobs in those areas.
Yeah, I mean,
so don't wait for the government to do this.
As I think about it, the two things you've mentioned were training and education, and healthcare. You know, the high end technical skills. Again, two industries that have to stay here.
Yes, absolutely. So I mean, you know, which is why I'm ultimately optimistic. Say all is not lost here for America, because also, what language do we speak? Right, the world is learning this language. Right, as many people out there have kids who have a Chinese nanny on the side, you still have to know English in this world. And a lot of people, whether you're in the Midwest or you're on the coast, you can actually be working around the clock doing website development and all of these sort of language services and training services for companies all over the world. And that too will bring profits. So we can people will outsource to us their need to do things in English to some degree. So.
That's a funny
thing. We need to be really creative, you know, obviously, but we can't just sit there and wait for the Obama administration that doesn't have the money, the Congress that doesn't have the money, the budget that just isn't there, to create some national re-education program. Remember, this has been promised since the 2004 election. John Edwards, John Kerry, everyone was talking about worker retraining. Where is that worker retraining? Go out, find a company to sponsor it.
So if you have hope and you look at the, you know, the bankruptcy of the states and the deficits of the federal government, it's really going to come from these partnerships. Is it happening?
It's happening in many places. I gave a couple of examples earlier of how it's happening here as well. And
McKinsey on
healthcare. Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think those sorts of things will crop up. I mean, it's worth looking at what wealthy philanthropists are doing in other parts of the world as well. The Indian industrial moguls, whether it's Wipro or Infosys, these companies, they founded their own universities, right? On the campuses of their companies are also these training academies where thousands of people are graduating every single year with a precise skill set that is usable invisible in the global economy for the next 10, 15, 20 years, they're going to have jobs, right? So we need to make sure that we do exactly the same thing.
Okay, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Parag Khanna. We're talking about the ideas in his new book, How to Run the World. You can learn more at paragkhanna.com. We've gone over it very quickly, but let me give you a moment to talk about what you mean by you say there's only one way to run the world with diplomacy, and then you coin a term, mega diplomacy.
Yeah.
What is that?
Diplomacy is the one word answer to how to run the world. It is the process by which we run management, right? Diplomacy is the system of global management, and it's broken. It's broken because we have just centralized institutions like the United Nations or the World Bank or the IMF. We don't have the mechanisms that actually decentralize resources, that allow people to help themselves, that help people help themselves, to allow people to live their own lives and build their own community or national level kind of strength. So what I'm pursuing in this book is a new diplomatic system, basically. And, you know, again, I challenge anyone to come up with a better one-word answer, because force doesn't work. I think we just learned that, right? Conquest isn't exactly the answer to running the world. Again, it's a process. What process? Right now, we just have crisis management, right?
That's right.
Crisis here, a financial crisis, a failed states crisis, natural disasters. That's not a process. Diplomacy is the process. Diplomacy is the system that we need to rebuild that includes everyone, not just governments. Because again, most of the governments of the world don't have the capacity to run themselves, let alone be influential players outside their own borders. So I'm looking for a system that harnesses the resources of the private sector, of civil society, and of governments. I never make either-or arguments. I don't say the state is gone, you know, rise of the corporations. It's all at the same time. What we need is to harness these resources. And I'm optimistic because the more players there are in diplomacy, the more resources are being put on the table. We have to assume that if there were no Microsoft, Google, Facebook, General Motors, whatever, out there creating jobs, and building products, well, then we'd just have governments, and we'd have a lot more problems already than we have now. So obviously the resources that governments alone provide are insufficient to solve the world's problems.
Mm-hmm. And let me go to a couple of things that I think would be retorts to what you're saying, which is that in America we can see with Citizens United growing, terribly expanding power of corporations over government, of government doing the bidding of corporations and so on, of the political process being undermined because it's now become, you know, a game that's run by big money. How does what you're talking about not fall prey to that sort of thing?
Well, look, again, it can't be a civil war between the public and the private sector. And we learned this with the financial crisis. No one wanted to see the entire financial system in the United States and the private banks actually collapse. And the way in which it was resuscitated, actually, the very explicit acronym for the bailout was the PPIP, the Public-Private Investment Program. And that allowed banks to buy into and citizens to buy into the bailout of these companies and then reap part of the reward and the profits from it. What are the things that we have to do in this economy? We have to innovate, clean technology, whatever the case may be, spreading broadband internet access around the country, infrastructure, all of these things that we need in this country. Who's actually going to do it? Are you going to become, if you're a construction worker, you're going to be working, you're going to be a construction worker for Uncle Sam? No. You need companies to do a lot of this stuff. So we need much more public-private types of vehicles to get these things done. So this either-or turf war isn't really going to work.
So how's it going to end?
Well, it's going to end.
I don't mean how's it going to turn out, but how are we going to get out of that? In other words, if you look at, you know, just an entity like the Chamber of Commerce in the U.S., right now seems to be an anti-government.
I talk about the example of the railroads in the United States, right? The charter companies that were built, where serving the state, providing public functions, building public infrastructure was a privilege to have gotten these, and this is how the Carnegie's
original,
and others. And
the original definition of a corporation was a corporation arose at the pleasure of the sovereign, which in America is the people, and was here to do a specific public good and then go out of existence. Well, we're not going to go back to that.
Not going out of business, but if you look at countries like India already, which is very weak in infrastructure and whose government doesn't have a lot of credibility nor a lot of money and is very corrupt, what they've had to do is actually to create these public-private vehicles and say, you major industrialists, cash rich with technology and with manpower, will you accept a certain lower than, you know, huge market profit, you know, ripping off the government rate of return to build infrastructure in this country and to bring in foreign investment to do it as well? So what's the proposal that's in the Senate right now? The National Infrastructure Bank, right? Again, drawing on as much investment as you can from the global private sector and other governments to issue municipal bonds, these kinds, so that we can build our infrastructure. That's how it's got to end. And that how
good,
it should, should
this go. Idea of publicly earmarked sort of banks.
Yeah.
I think North Dakota is the only state that has one.
Is that right? Yeah.
And they've done very well in this crisis.
Yeah. How about utilities? Utilities in certain states, like Florida and others, that are actually drawing investment in so they can invest in clean technology, solar power, wind power, and so forth, and deploy these through their utility grids and things like this, and actually refunding certain costs to citizens who generate power through these. So this kind of public-private cooperation can have a lot of good, and it can be financially beneficial as well.
Hmm. God, it just seems so challenging. Also, one of the other things, you actually have a chapter called The New Colonialism.
Yeah.
I you know, it's provocative, if not inflammatory,
right.
Word. And you I'll just pull one quote from that, and then I want you to talk about that. Ultimately, the removal of tyrants should come from and be owned by the country's own citizenry. Until popular uprisings can overcome police states and cults of personality, progressive interventionists will have to continue to be guileful and even play God in the name of saving people from their leaders. Now, having seen our adventures, most recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, this sounds like dangerous stuff.
Well, progressive, I remember I say progressive interventionists, right? And you know, what we did in Iraq was more than just remove a bad leader, right? That's what we kind of probably should have done back in 1991. But it's what comes next. Did we need to occupy the country? Did we need to set up our own governance where we have a viceroy running the country? Probably not. That's not what I call helping others help themselves. So Iraq is not the argument against what I'm saying about new public-private coalitions that can help build failed states. People power is like
Tunisia. I'm talking about the removal of. In other words,
right.
how does one influence the removal of? And what you're saying is that in many of these states, that will make a huge difference.
Yeah, it absolutely will.
Because very often the log jam, the corruption is really starts.
Omar Bashir in Sudan, Mugabe in Zimbabwe, you know, the Kim Jong Il regime, the Ivory Coast. You know, I'm talking about assassinations. Let's be perfectly clear. And there's a section of the chapter that you're talking about that's explicitly about assassinations. And I say there's certain people whose grip on power and whose subjugation of the population is so severe and so immoral that we can either let them hold on for literally years and years and years to come, or we can find ways to creative ways, potentially by assassinating them, to unleash a new dynamic in the country so that the people might be able to take control again. So yes, that is what I'm talking about.
That is what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I like the end result, but who has the moral authority? Who is in your recommendation, who is performing those assassinations?
Well, first of all, we do have indictments against sitting heads of state like Omar Bashir of Sudan because of the Darfur genocide and other sorts of things. So there's a global legal justification for these kinds. The only question is, are we willing to execute on it? Pardon the pun. This is done by a variety of ways. We have had multinational peacekeeping forces backed by NATO hunting for warlords in Uganda and in Congo, for example. They've been out to kill these warlords who've been massacring people. So that legal justification is there, and we're already trying to do it. So at the end of the day, whether the trigger puller is someone from the U.S. military or some international force is kind of less important than, you know, sort of it's just who has access, who can get the closest. But there are other things to undermine a regime. I don't know if we work hard enough at it because it seems so tedious in a way and so slow. And
well, I think it goes very, very much back to the very first thing we said, which was about complexity versus simplicity.
Yeah.
It seems to me that we tend to continue to deal with the tyrant,
the
devil we know, rather than...
Whereas we could be bribing military officers, trying to flood cell phones and things into the country, trying to get smuggled goods across
and
the borders.
And who's the we in that?
We
is it the U.S.
of,
or
oh,
is
it's,
it...
It's NGOs, too. It's, there's quite a few NGOs who are very active in this regard. And it's in the major players that you know of, human rights organizations and so forth.
Sunshine and transparency and publicity is not is a piece of it, but not enough.
It's not enough at the end of the day. If there is a tyrant, whether it is the president of Uzbekistan or Belarus or other sorts of places, I'm not saying that these particular gentlemen should be killed. I'm not playing God myself here. I am saying though that certain figures again who are so entrenched, we have to be again guileful is the word I use, and continue to erode and chip away at their power, and eventually they will fall. And that we should be accelerating this process rather than just assuming that, like Musharraf was a great example. We backed Musharraf for a very long time. I mean, he was corrupt to the core from day one, and I certainly knew it, and others should have as well. But a lot of people supported him. We supported him. We said, oh, there's no alternative. What are you going to do? I will always prefer a little bit of a chaotic democratic aftermath and see what happens than to say, oh, well, he's just our son of a bitch, and let's just stick with him because he'll be around for a long time. Sure enough, look at Tunisia, look at Pakistan, look around the world, these guys go. And you don't want to be on the wrong side of history, right? You want to be on the side of the people who are going to take power, because otherwise you suffer from blowback. If you're backing the dictator and they get him and they hang him in the street, they're not going to like you anymore.
Well, the thing I noticed when Hamas won the election in Palestine, or when Ahmadinejad won the election in Iran, was we acted like the good guy lost. No, in both cases, the most corrupt guy lost,
right.
Whether it was Rafsanjani or the PLO.
Well, these movements like Hamas or Ahmadinejad's party or others, I mean, they're obviously corrupt in themselves, but the platform is very anti-corruption because the entrenched parties, take Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, right? The incredibly corrupt regime has been in power for almost 30 years. Muslim Brotherhood's platform has nothing to do with Islam. Look, if you don't have to read Arabic to go look this up online. Look at the Muslim Brotherhood's actual platform as they gain seats in the Egyptian parliament. It's all about transparency, about good governance, about service delivery. It's an anti-corruption platform. It's perfectly 100% legitimate. And other parties are copying that model too. And I think, again, what they're doing is what it tells us with the Muslim Brotherhood, with Hamas, with opposition parties, because they might come to power.
That's right.
If you want them to democratize, you have to assume that they might win.
And if you keep backing the corrupt establishment, push for elections,
yeah,
it's a recipe for loss.
Exactly. So either you're pro-democracy no matter who wins, or you're really just, just pandering.
Right. And if you are going to be pro-democracy, then you've got to really engage.
Absolutely.
Is very much
you've
what
you're
saying.
You've got to play
all sides. If I give you one more minute, what should people be... Yeah, it flies by.
Yeah.
What should people be paying attention to? What should they be looking at that they're not?
I think, we're here in California. Look at how California has a progressive approach towards emissions and things like this for automobiles and the climate policy in general. There is, at the local level, very important ways to influence the global level. Look at Kiva and other websites where you can donate resources to important causes around the world and help start businesses around the world. You can even buy equity in these businesses. You can even invest in them through pension funds by convincing your employer to put a greater share of their pension funds into emerging markets and developing countries. There are so many things, amazingly, that each individual can do. Business school students take time out to make business plans for small companies in Africa and in South Asia. You can do this. You can voluntarily.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that I was struck by in the book, How to Run the World, several times you speak to the reader and you say, when I say mega diplomacy and I say it's about, not just the government, I mean you.
I mean you.
Yeah. Okay, we'll leave it at that. The book, again, is How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. The website is paragkhana.com. That's paragkhanna.com. Thank you to Parag Khanna. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Ted.